Welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast, where you'll learn how to structure terms and use various creative financing strategies to create profitable deals for short and long-term wealth. Whether you're a buy and hold investor, wholesaler, or flipper, learning creative financing will help you do more deals and unlock profits that you may not even know existed. On the Creative Financing Podcast, we break down actual deals we and our guests are doing and simplify the methods and terms used to execute these strategies. Now, let's dive in and create some terms.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Gallegos, here with
Jeff Rappaport.
And today we have a very special guest by the name of Jax Petty. He's an attorney. He practices here in Utah. Any other states, Jax?
No, just Utah.
Okay. Jeff, tell us about him. You're the one that got him onto the show. You use him and his title company quite a bit. So give us a brief introduction.
So I actually know Jax through his father. I met his father years ago. And when I got back into real estate 4 or so years ago, that his son had now basically taken over. And Jax specializes in contract for deed and some different kind of seller financing strategies. He's an attorney and he owns a title company. It's kind of like the perfect
match,
all-in-one type deal. So I'm super excited to have you. Thank you for being here. Someone that I do business with, but who I consider a friend. So
a pleasure, Jeff.
Thanks, Jax.
I didn't know that. So you knew his dad, and then you took over the business. Okay, cool.
Yeah, and actually I met his dad through a mutual friend who's a mortgage broker here that I've known for many years, Andy.
Andy, yes.
Yes, so I'm super excited about today. What we're going to do is I'm going to just ask Jax a whole bunch of questions. He is a wealth of knowledge, so we'll get a different perspective on some things, and hopefully it'll be really informative for everyone out there.
Great. Jax, tell us a little bit about yourself. How long you've been in law or real estate specifically, what you invest in, any hobbies you might want to mention.
So I'm a native Utah. I did move out of state a little bit because I figured if I grew up here, it must be a boring place to live, and quickly found I love the mountains and love the people, and came back, paid my way through college and law school, and started a business, got married. I've been in real estate since 96. I personally have done quite a bit of investing, and I've always found that it's been an enjoyable pursuit. Right now we're doing some storage units and a little development work, and each market has an opportunity. And I think right now there's a lot of institutional money getting thrown at good projects, so those are a little easier at the moment than they were, say, 5 years ago.
Okay. Cool.
So, Jax, how did you became an attorney? Did you specialize in real estate law, or how did you get into the title business, and how did it all come together?
I actually started working at a title company in 1994 and then became licensed in 96. I've always loved transactional work. Never been a big fan of personal injury or litigation, although I love being in front of a judge. It's very painful to divorce your family for 3 months to prepare for a case. So it just seemed to be a very good fit, and it's something I've always enjoyed and always been good at. And I think there are few things better than real estate, at least in this country, to enjoy doing well at.
Great. So, and I'm going to ask this question. I already know that you are a serious wealth of knowledge on it, but I want to get an idea of what your opinions are on the real estate market here locally and kind of nationally, because I know you have an opinion.
Yes. So, you know, Utah has always been a little bit of a microcosm when it comes to real estate, especially the Wasatch Front. We've, by a significant margin, got the youngest population in the nation. We have kind of organic growth that, that pushes some trends that are sometimes counter-cyclical to the rest of the nation. But it doesn't mean that we're so insular that we're not affected by those issues. I think a great example is the last crash. If you study the data, we still had a starter home housing shortage in 2009. But people watched the national media, lending tightened up, subprime disappeared. And so even though logically we should have had forces that would have carried us through different, and it certainly was different than other parts of the nation, but because people then believed there was an issue, anytime the general populace believes there's an issue, there is, whether logically there should be or not. So I think, you know, in watching what happened in the lead up to the big crash, it's interesting to feel the similarities as to what's going on right now, and that's the best way I can explain it. I mean, we have securitization of mortgages again, we have subprime again, we have 100% financing again, we have stated income again, all of the things that supposedly were the major causes of the big crash are back. And, you know, one of the my favorite indices to look at is the affordability of housing index, because it shows real world what people can afford. And it's been some time that Utah pushed past the average Utah family being able to afford the average Utah home. And this year, we're kind of in a new territory. The average Utah family can afford to rent the average Utah home. And so I think, and you always hope that there's not, you know, the market likes to call it a correction, not the same correction that took place
a little over the crash. We're trying to call this one a correction, right?
Right. Okay. We're hoping this one's a correction. The estimates are kind of in the 20 to 30% range, probably around the end of 2020. But if there's any number of things that could change that. But I think there are opportunities in this market that maybe weren't opportunities in 2010, but there are definitely opportunities, more opportunities in my opinion, that will present themselves when the next correction, or as you put it, crash hits.
And I'm not positive if it's going to, you know, nationwide it might be more of a crash, Utah might be more of a correction, and I think it's a pretty gray area because it's really just a matter of degree, right? Mm-hmm. So, but interest rates rising, prices of housing rising, not helping the affordability of housing right now. Would you agree?
I would agree. And the other thing that's always been just fascinating to me, for example, in 06, I was in a sell mode. I mean, for most of the things I've got that aren't in the commercial realm, I'm in a sell mode again. And when you ask people what they should do when investing, they'll proffer the buy low, sell high. But the lemmings don't function that way, do they, Jeff?
No.
I mean, right now, people know that properties are probably a little inflated as far as value, and everyone's trying to buy. And in 2010, everyone knew they were undervalued, and almost no one was competing
right
to buy those properties.
Yep.
So I find that fascinating.
I do too. It's like when the market's great, everyone wants into real estate. Everyone. Yet when the market's bottoming out, people get out of real estate.
Right.
Kind of counterintuitive as far as what you should be trying to accomplish. It's kind of interesting.
So I want to ask you, why storage units? And you're developing, are you holding these and then stabilizing them and then selling to an institutional buyer? Or I kind of want to dive into that a little bit, and whether you think, you know, is there some recession proof in self-storage, in your opinion, and kind of what you're doing in that realm?
So I made a study of what thrived in the recession, I would make the argument that people always need a place to live, so rents generally are not going to crash. And I think in Utah, if you study the data, they initially decreased a little bit, but it's not significantly, and have steadily increased since that point. But there were two things that really thrived during the recession as far as real estate. Commercial office space, in case you're wondering, was not one of those things. But you had storage units.
Okay.
And you had trailer parks.
Okay.
I'm not a big fan of trailer parks. In fact, that's why I don't manage any of my own rentals, is because I am a lousy landlord from the standpoint of, you know, if you call our office and have us work as attorneys to evict someone, we'll get it done quickly and efficiently. But if one of my own people calls and says, hey, my car broke and my daughter was ill and they can show that to me, I'm the type that'll say, don't worry about paying the rent this month, you know? So,
gotcha.
But, so that's why I think storage units intrigued me. And also, everyone I've spoken to that's been in storage units has always regretted if they ever sold and never regretted if they held.
Interesting.
You have a very quick and easy default process. You don't have, you know, you're not kicking people out in the street. And when the recession hit and people lost their big homes, they had to put all that stuff somewhere.
Yeah, very true.
And so, you know, I mean, it's nothing is truly recession or depression proof, but those seem to thrive during those periods. So I the strange thing is we've not marketed this at all. But we've had 5 unsolicited offers to buy these already.
Oh, wow.
Are they already built?
So they are constructed.
Okay.
You know, we've phased it, so there's some parts that we're still completing. But, you know, usually you want to get to an 80% occupancy rate before you see the type of offers that are coming in. But just to give you an idea, there's a unit near ours, not nearly as good of a condition, that sold at a 4 cap rate.
Wow.
I don't know who would buy anything at a 4. I wouldn't buy anything at a 4 cap rate.
1031 money or institutional money.
There's a lot of REITs. Institutional. Yeah, the REITs have come in pretty hard to Utah. Both coasts have come into Utah storage pretty hard. And it's been interesting. But no, that's why storage units.
Okay, cool. I like that.
What so is the goal to hold them?
That's the goal, but some of the offers are proving difficult to say no.
Sure.
Because I could sell these, and you know, next market cycle when people are just dumping things, and cities are a little more flexible, find, you know, some more great places to do them, but. I don't know if there's a lose scenario in that, but I'd love to hold on to them, but also I'm not going to, you know, if somebody makes a stupid offer, they're stupid to say no to.
No doubt.
I will not be stupid.
Yep. So real quick, right back to what we were talking about, where do you see, like, nationwide market? What are your thoughts in terms of the real estate market?
So the same hot spots you saw before, and again, I'll go back to the 05, 06, and early 07. You know, Vegas is going crazy again. You've got a whole bunch going on in Arizona. All of those spots that fell really hard are hyperinflated, and you know, people are throwing money at those.
Seattle, parts of California.
Seattle's got a pretty good tech balance to kind of keep.
Justify it.
Well, yeah, Seattle certainly is overvalued because of that, but not compared to a place like Las Vegas, where there's really not something where if people aren't throwing away disposable income, you're not going to have an easy time of filling those units. But
yeah. There's no diversification.
I see a lot of similarities, and it when I say it, it feels very similar. Let me give you an example. Starting in late 2005, you'd go to a foreclosure sale, and our firm's done thousands of foreclosure sales. And you would see people, so let's use today's numbers. Let's say that the ARV, the after repaired value, is going to be $320,000. And it needs $40,000 in repairs to get it there. You see people bidding it up to $300,000. Now, I'm no mathematician.
Sight unseen.
Yeah. But that doesn't seem like it's a logical way to be investing. But we're seeing that same cycle hitting now. I've got, you know, several friends and clients that do foreclosure sale purchases. And a lot of them are going into hard money lending because it's just very difficult to find anything that's not upside down by the time the bidding stops.
Yep. I can tell you that just recently we joined a mastermind group, and the guy that runs it buys 30 to 50 properties a month. And where he was getting a significant amount of his properties was through online auctions. And in the last 30 days, he stopped, just because it's gotten so outrageously, not even competitive, but over the top, people overpaying. He's like, I'm done. That strategy is no longer working for me. So,
and that's kind of an indication, because he invests in multiple states, right? He buys.
He does, but primarily in Florida. So, okay. Yeah. But we're starting to see a lot of the same types of things that we saw in 2000, you know, end of 2006, 2007, into 2008.
What Jax calls similarities. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
All right. So really what I want to talk to you about today is you kind of specialize in contract for deed, some different owner financing strategies. We've talked about, that's what this podcast is all about, is creative financing. And we have done in-depth about here's what contract for deed is as, you know, compared to subject to trust deed and note, all-inclusive, all of them. But I want to get your perspective because, you know, when I have questions, I come to you. So, so first of all, being the market being so good, I would imagine that there's so many people out there that think that seller financing does not work. Why would anyone possibly look at taking seller financing right now if they could literally go put their property on the market and potentially get, you know, multiple offers in the next few weeks?
Well, I think certainly a lot of the panic sale sellers we saw in 2010 that you could walk up to and say, I will take your house, and they would thank you for doing it. That certainly we're not seeing.
Right.
But surprisingly, we haven't seen a significant decline in the number of seller financing transactions that come through our doors. I think part of that is there are a lot more agents that have an understanding of it, and therefore not so much of a fear of it. But also, you still have people that are buying properties, getting transferred for their jobs, losing jobs, having issues, and it takes 10% of the property's value to sell a property.
Right.
So if you think of that segment, they're still out there, and there's more than you might think that needs somebody to take the property off their home. So why would it work for them, and why would it work for an investor in that scenario? Well, the investor can afford to go in and pay them to get out of the property, which if they, you know, if they need 10% to sell and they don't have that in equity, which most people are buying with 3.5% down, so that's not a rare occurrence. You find people that want to sell. And that investor can then take and sell that property to a seller finance buyer that's going to pay 10 or 20% above market. Now, sometimes I think people are short-sighted when they hear that, and they think that maybe that individual is being taken advantage of. And certainly everything has the opportunity for somebody to take advantage of someone. But most of the investors that we see, when they do that type of transaction, the buyers are extremely grateful. And I think I put myself in their place, especially if they can't buy a home. If they are
credit challenged,
self-employed, maybe they don't have the correct documentation yet as far as immigration. Yep. If I was living in another country, that's where I was living and raising my family, and for my family's existence, I can't even hang a picture because I don't own the walls.
Yep.
I would definitely save up money. I would definitely put a big down payment down, and I would pay, if I had to, above market pricing to get a home for my family.
Yep.
Because that is something that I want. And frankly, owning real property, owning your own home, is part of who you are.
Yep.
Again, there's always the possibility for somebody to be taken advantage of, but I really don't see that often. And the numbers work out, especially when you factor in, I'll give you a transaction from somebody you and I both know, and they put about $20,000 down on this property. It was actually a distressed property, but it didn't have a lot of equity. So a lot of other investors were overlooking it. But with the $20,000, he was able to reinstate the loan, and he was able to get title, and he was able to get 30 years to pay off the loan.
Yep. Yeah. So like a subject to kind of,
yeah,
or contract for deed, one of the two.
Right. And I think, you know, when you hear that I specialize in contract for deed, it's not that it's my favorite or I like it more or something like that, but it is a tool that is extremely valuable for investors, because ideally, I'll tell you what I like to do. I like to get into properties. My goal is to get in for $10,000 down and then make 400% on my down payment when I sell. And I want to buy on an all-inclusive, because that's the strongest position for a buyer. But I want to sell on a contract for deed for two reasons. One, it's not a lease where I have to go fix toilets, which drives me, as you could probably guess, insane.
Yep.
I don't have any liability. I'm just the bank. But two, because on a contract sale, you retain title. If the buyer defaults, it's a 30-day forfeiture process.
And we're going to get into that. I'm going to ask you specifically about that. As far as the transactions that you're seeing through the title company, your title company, mm-hmm. So the amount of seller financing deals is still pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
What transactions are you seeing most of? So is it subject to, is it all-inclusive, is it contract for deed, is it pretty equal?
So some people treat subject to as a different animal than an all-inclusive. But if they were aware of kind of the judicial landscape, they would call them one and the same. For example, I have one investor that came to me because he was having the problem where he was doing subject to, he was just taking the deed, and judges categorically do not like that.
Yeah.
They want to see what they're expecting, and in a judge's mind, they don't understand why anyone would just sign a deed. And so what happened to him, not once but twice, is he went in and he bought it subject to. He gave the seller no remedy in the case that he defaulted. And the seller came to an attorney and told them this story, which, knowing the investor, I don't believe to be true.
Okay.
But told the attorney, hey, this person came into my house. They said they'd help me catch up the payments. They'd give me a loan. And it turns out they fraudulently stole my property. Mm. Now, in the meantime, the investors fixed up the property. So now it's worth a lot more. And every time he has had to settle for a significant amount, because the judge looked at him as if he was an evil human being. So when you say subject to, it's fine to take it subject to the mortgage, but make sure and do it with the documentation that a judge is going to expect. Settlement statements, an all-inclusive deed of trust and note that states that it's only subject to the underlying mortgage, and your obligation as the buyer is to make the underlying payment, etc. Because then you're in a very strong position. The judge looks at it, and people don't really understand. Judges are under incredible time pressure. They've got a calendar they have to get through. And you think you have people that want to talk when you want to shut them up? Imagine attorneys, right, in a room trying to basically shout each other.
Yep.
Well, converse with each other. Convince the judge. And so you have to take that into account. So, yes, subject to is great as long as it's done correctly. All-inclusive. Usually, I guess you're saying there's an additional balance owed to the seller, which is not
necessarily.
Okay.
So when I'm looking at what the differences are between subject to, is exactly what you just said. Subject to is, I got the deed. There's no remedy for the seller in case of default. all-inclusive, I could still just wrap the existing debt. That's all that the seller is getting. But now the seller does have a remedy. Now it's... I like how you kind of put it where don't give the judge a reason to rule against you, because it may look like you've taken advantage of someone. Whether you did or you didn't, I mean, this happened 2006. I mean, there were a bunch of pre-foreclosure laws that came into effect based on the amount of complaints that, and whether true or not, that people were coming in, stealing people's houses, and basically taking them subject to, and either making the payment or not, but giving the seller no recourse. So that's how I kind of define it.
You're right. And put yourself in the judge's position for a moment. You're looking at investor, so they've got money, right? Savvy. You're looking at family about to be on the street.
Right.
Automatically, you want to rule for one of those parties.
Yeah.
And it's not the rich investor, whether the investor is rich or not. So I think doing it correctly is a good way. But back to your initial question, and I'll finish with kind of that example I was giving. So buying an all-inclusive is great. He got in for $20,000. He sold it on a 30-year term for a family to put down over $120,000 on a contract for deed. Now, who was still on title? The investor was.
Right.
Buyer defaults, he's got a fairly quick remedy. I've never seen anyone put $120,000 down on a lease option. Maybe it's been done, but I personally haven't seen it. So I think it's a great tool to understand on how to do some additional transactions.
Yep, I would totally agree. I think you kind of answered this question earlier. Is so if you're doing your own investing, what particular strategy do you like? And I think that you had mentioned if you're buying, you would like to buy on a trust deed and note or an all-inclusive trust deed and note.
Right.
And if you're selling, you'd prefer to sell on contract for deed. You want to go into that just a little bit?
I do, and there are a couple of caveats I want to mention right off the bat, and that is there are certain loans that I as an investor would not purchase as an all-inclusive. And there's a lot of, you know, rumor and history and different things. But if you don't know what I'm talking about, the FHA has a list that every time a lender does an FHA loan, they have to submit who's the title company, who's the escrow officer, who's the agent, who's the seller. If it's a corporate seller, an LLC, they have to submit the names of the members of the LLC. And if any of those come up on their, I'll call it the naughty list, they will not loan on that transaction. So for me as a real estate professional with the title company as well, I certainly didn't want to end up on that list, and I didn't want my company to end up on that list.
Pretty much no one wants to be on that list.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, you would, in some markets, be dead in the water if you were on that list. So I spent actually 6 months calling till I finally was able to arrange a meeting with the regional director for FHA, the vice president, and then this was one of their offices back east, head legal counsel, and then their head of operations. And I just asked the questions because I wanted to know. Some of the answers I kind of didn't want to know because I thought they might be answers I didn't want to hear, but
sure.
Here's what was asked and what was said. You know, I brought up the naughty list, and I said, can you get on that list if you do a lease option? And they said, you know, technically a lease option is a violation of the due on sale clause, but no, that would not get you on the list. They said, what about a lease? And they said, a lease for a period of less than 2 years would be fine. Above 2 years, we actually would also consider that a violation technically, although we don't pursue that. And so then I asked about, what about a contract sale? And back east, they use contract sales quite a bit. Contract for deed is very understood by the...
Also called like a land contract a lot.
Also called a land contract, also called a bond for deed. There are different names. There are actually some states that have different statutory requirements for the default process, but Utah sticks to the forfeiture process, which is the 30-day process. And they said, no, a contract for deed will not get you on that list, but an all-inclusive will, a subject to will. And so my office knows we will not close an all-inclusive over an FHA loan.
Subject to would get you on that list.
So it's an interesting phrasing. The exact phrasing is seller financing where title transfers. Okay. So theoretically, if you did a lease option and then recorded a deed later, I haven't seen that tested.
Yep.
You know, but so I you know, I think on an FHA loan, if you're buying it and you're going to use the seller's existing financing, I would highly recommend staying off of that list and doing a contract for deed. Now, here's one really cool thing. I did the research with VA loans. Not only did they not have an issue with it, but they put out a circular that stated they didn't even consider a contract for deed sale to be a violation of a due on sale clause, which allows for some really cool things if you combine it with an assumption. So if you have an end buyer, imagine how valuable this is. You go, you buy a VA loan property on a contract for deed, and it's, you know, it's a few years old, so it's got 3.5%. Maybe he's been paying on it, or she or they, for 5 years, 7 years. Could you go out to a buyer and sell this? I have a loan at 3.5% with only 23 years left. This many thousands of dollars in interest have already been paid that you're not going to have to pay. So I've got two assets I'm selling now. I've got the house and I've got the financing.
Yep.
And yes, a non-veteran can assume a VA loan. So there's some really cool things you can do to maximize the value. You didn't fix it up. You just brought a financing that no longer exists as far as interest rate. And, you know, for somebody, if somebody had offered me that when I was, you know, just starting, hey, to buy your own house, how about this? You've only got a little over 20 years instead of 30.
Yep.
Most of, because of the amortization, most of the high interest payments are already taken care of, and you're getting a rate that no one can get.
Yep.
That would be powerful.
What are the, in terms of assuming that loan, what are the qualifications to actually assume it? Do you know?
I do. So FHA has qualified assumptions. VA has qualified assumptions. The last simple assumption FHA loan expired in 2016. The last simple assumption VA loan will be September of this year, but I doubt any still exist. So you're talking about a qualified assumption, and it's just, do you meet the actual requirements to get a new FHA or VA loan? We handled one fairly recently where the person bought it on a contract for deed, and then instead of going out and refinancing with a new 30-year loan, by the time they were done with the contract, it was an 18-year loan and a fabulous interest rate.
Yep.
So you can do some cool things when you combine that, but maybe that's another day.
And just a couple, just because this is a fascinating topic, you don't have to be a veteran to qualify for the VA loan.
To assume one, no.
To assume one.
No.
So that's, I mean, that's huge.
It is. Yeah. We've got Hill Air Force Base.
Yep.
We've got military establishment, you know, Camp Williams. You've got a bunch of bases and military personnel. They get transferred to Germany. They need to do something with their property. And here's one more golden tidbit, because I think the art of negotiation is letting somebody else have your way. That's always been my belief.
Okay.
And if, especially in a distressed property situation, their credit's already shot. They're not going to get a loan within a year. And so if you can go in and show them how, by doing this, they're going to be able to fix their credit, because you're going to be making sure that payment's made. And then in shorter time than if they just sold it to you, you talked about putting it out on the market, right?
Right.
That's not going to fix their credit necessarily. On-time payments on their mortgage are going to do much more good than just selling it. So if they really want to buy another house again, they may choose you over a standard offer. But then, here's the golden nugget. After 12 months of payments, they can go out and buy another house and offset the previous home on their debt ratios. So this argument you'll run into sometimes is, well, I want to buy another house. And especially if they're in a, you know, a distressed situation, it's going to help them achieve that goal much more quickly selling it to you as a seller finance buyer.
Sure. And, you know, just to add a little detail to that, I've done some research on it, and it's possible to even do it before 12 months.
It is.
It's really about how you show it on your taxes. So if you, as you should be, if you've sold the house, you should be claiming that you've sold the house. And once, you know, and not all mortgage brokers are the same. So
competent? Oh, you mean the same. Sorry.
They won't all treat this exactly the same. So you
all
might have
my mortgage clients are very competent. Just want to state that.
So you might have to do a little searching, but it's possible to get it done even sooner if the seller files their tax return and shows it as a sale.
That's correct.
Okay, guys, I think we're going to stop it right here and make this a two-part episode because this is going to be a really long conversation. So literally on the next episode, guys, we're just going to pick up right where we left off in this conversation from here out. So I hope you are enjoying this. Please go to iTunes and send us a rate and review our show. We'd love to, you know, some feedback from you guys. We need your love, so show your love, guys. You can reach us at www.thecreativefinancingpodcast.com. Again, www.thecreativefinancingpodcast.com. Thanks so much, guys, for listening. And until next time, create some terms.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Financing Podcast. We need your feedback to continue to bring you the best strategies in creative financing. So please subscribe, rate, and review this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We greatly appreciate your ear, and please pass this on. Until next time, create some terms. This show offers general information on creative financing strategies and real estate investments. Nothing contained herein should be considered personal, legal, or financial advice. Every state has individual laws governing the use and type of documents used to execute strategies discussed herein. You should consult with a local licensed real estate broker and attorney before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed, and opinions of the guests are their own. Profits are not guaranteed, and there's always inherent risk in real estate investing.